3802 of the Survival Podcast. Today we're going to answer your question, what is wiping out turkey flocks? This is a new one on me. I guess, you know, I try to learn as much as I can about all of this stuff, but things like this you tend to learn about when you have to. And when do you have to? When you go outside and you start seeing your turkeys dropping over and you lose half or 70% or even 100% of your flock from a very lethal illness. And this lethal illness is known as blackhead disease. And it can do some things that, you know, that's why the name's there. But as I was doing research for this after I got our guest's application, when you look internally at like the damage it does to a liver and all, it's a pretty horrific disease. It's a parasitic disease, and it specifically tends to affect pastured turkeys. And we're going to be talking with C.J. Lafferty here in just a minute, who has had some pretty catastrophic losses on the turkeys he's running on pasture, and then has figured out some ways to mitigate that so that if you want to raise turkeys, you can take his advice and either eliminate or prevent it or at least mitigate it if it turns up. I've said many times the easiest meat I've ever run has been the turkeys that I've run here on my little farm. And, you know, I've run these broad-breasted bronze, and I have raised these turkeys. And the way I've described them is they're kind of like, for 6 weeks, they try to kill themselves. And from 7 weeks forward, they're like little Mack trucks. Like, unless it's like a bobcat or something, they're fine. And then you find out about something like this. And since I have encouraged you guys to run turkeys, I also want to encourage you guys to know about this illness. And CJ will be on with us in just a moment to talk about it and what can be done about it. And I'll tell you straight up front, there is no silver bullet easy answer, but there are definitely things that can be done. With that, before we dig into it, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day today. Sponsor day number one today is canineacademy.us. That's Joel Ryle's online training program to help you learn how to better train your dogs and make your dog a good citizen in the home and on the homestead. Doesn't matter what you want to do. If you want a protection dog, a livestock guardian dog, just a good dog that doesn't jump on your guests and tear the pillows off your couch and stuff, it all starts with core obedience, and you can build on it from there. You can even take a free training class at canineacademy.us called the Problem Solving Library. That'll get a feel for things for you, and you can decide if this is the right training for you, and then Joel has many other options for you there. Joel also offers fully trained protection dogs, started puppies, and obedience-trained dogs as well at his sister site, Fortress Canine, and you can check that as well. He's taking reservations, as I understand right now, for pups that are dropping sort of as we speak. Next up today, I want to remind you guys about our newest sponsor. These guys came on board not very long ago, thecaseplace.com. Again, thecaseplace.com. These guys are great, man. They actually pick up stranded inventory, slightly damaged cases, et cetera, like that, fully repair them and warranty them. And they're selling top-end storage cases from brands like Pelican, Hardig, SKB, and others. This is top-end gear for 50 to 80% off retail right out of the gate. Plus, MSB members, you get another 10%. And TSP listeners, even if you're not an MSB member, you can get an additional 5% off your order at thecaseplace.com. For non-members, the code is TSP. If you want the bigger discount because you're a member, you got to log in, because if I tell you that, then it's no longer an exclusive member's discount, right? It becomes a public discount, and there's no more value in the MSB for it. But CasePlace is awesome. And guys, just think about how expensive some of the gear we have is. Optics, camera gear, obviously guns and ammo and other stuff that we travel with. You know, when you have expensive gear, you want to protect it. It's worth the investment in a top-end case. We're lucky to have thecaseplace.com with us. With that, I want to bring our special guest on, and that is C.J. Lafferty. I've clicked the button three times, and there he finally showed up. We had a little gremlin working against us. Hey, C.J., man, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me. I greatly appreciate the opportunity.
Well, like I said, I was intrigued when your guest application came in. I'm like, what is this? And then I looked it up, and I'm like, oh, hell yeah, we got to talk about this, because I know somebody else out there has dealt with it and or will deal with it in the future. So can we start off out of the gate, though? What exactly is blackhead disease, and why is it such a serious problem for pasture-raised birds, specifically turkeys?
Blackhead is a parasite, ultimately. Histomoniasis mellagratus is the scientific term, but it's a worm. And its life cycle involves two stages. Stage one, so typically it's a problem on shared flocks or farms that have run chickens over the same ground that turkeys will eventually go over. But the chicken eats either the egg or an earthworm, because earthworms serve as carriers for the parasite as well. The parasite doesn't hurt the earthworm, but it just kind of gets transported, moved around, spread, etc. That's probably how it got onto my farm, is like a bird was flying over with a worm and dropped this infected worm, and then boom, you know. But it was a horse farm before, so I don't see how else it would have got here.
Okay.
So anyway, the chicken eats it, either the worm or the egg. The worm gets into its digestive tract, and then off the digestive tract are these sacs called cecum or ceca. And the worm gets in there, and in a chicken, doesn't really cause a lot of problem. You probably never even would notice it with your chickens. But eventually, the chicken will let this parasite develop to the next stage of its life, where it's ready to go back into a state of dormancy, into an egg. It'll excrete it onto the ground, and then either a turkey will come behind, eat it, and then let it go through stage two, which destroys the turkey, or an earthworm will eat it and kind of carry it around. Or the eggs can actually exist on the surface of your farm, when in your soil, inches deep or whatever, wherever the worm leaves it, for 3-4 years with no heat, doesn't hurt it, cold doesn't hurt it. You know, it's just there and very ruggedized in the egg state.
It sounds like Like almost like a science fiction horror story if it affected people, right? Like, but fortunately, sure, it doesn't. It's more of a turkey problem. How did you first realize you had a blackhead problem, and what kind of impact did it have on your farm over the last couple of years?
So we've raised turkeys for, this will be our sixth year. In the first 2 years, no problem. I was raising relatively small numbers, 6, 7, 8 turkeys, just for family and friends for Thanksgiving.
Okay.
Just kind of to figure out turkeys before I made it a commercial enterprise. And then the only problems I ever had losing turkeys was through predation. I actually have what's called goshawks around here, which is it looks like an osprey, but it's the size of a golden eagle. And we had a nesting pair. And they don't care how big the turkey is. They would come in and take 2 or 3 at a shot. So a pretty powerful bird. You know where I'm at. I'm in central Pennsylvania here, just south of Schuylkill County.
Oh.
So this is 2 weeks
in a row. So
I heard last week.
You were just north of me about 30 the mushroom miles. Farmer. You're just south of me about 30 miles. That's crazy. Yep. Go ahead.
I'm in Berks County near Hamburg.
Okay.
So, all right. But. Yeah, small world. But anyway, so I'd never had any problems with turkeys. If I started with 20 turkeys, I would finish 20 turkeys 4 months later, minus the predators. But then one day I come out, and the turkeys had been on pasture for maybe 4 weeks. So they're about 8 weeks old at that point. And I would just notice one or two of them starting to look really sad, separating themselves from the flock, not being social. Like, normally my turkeys are almost like dogs. And these guys were just heads drooped. They weren't gaining weight. Their wings were dragging on the ground. They looked just generally sad. And then I started noticing almost fluorescent yellow droppings. So it is bright yellow. And that is the number one indicator that you have a blackhead problem, is bright yellow feces. And that's the cecum infection being passed through the digestive tract. It creates a very bright yellow pus. But you'll see it. It's almost fluorescent. And once you have that, you know you got a problem, right? So within that first year, I lost like 2-3 birds. I jumped on Google and started saying, what could be this? the dead giveaway was the yellow feces. So easy search said, hey, perform a quick necropsy. Look at one of the livers. When I pulled the liver out of the dead bird, it looked like it had been shot with bird shot. So it's not just like lesions. It is actual holes in the liver. Literally like you shot it with bird shot, right? So that was a very strong confirmer. So I started looking at mitigation, right? There's no drugs you could give them, and I wouldn't give them drugs anyway because I'm selling them for meat. Some people had reported anecdotal success by feeding cayenne pepper. So I didn't know, you know, I sprinkled a little bit of pepper on top of their feed thinking turkey ain't going to like pepper. The turkey doesn't care. No, not at all. They gobble it up, right? So, yeah. But I wasn't dosing high enough. So my birds kept dying. Then I just coated the entire, I feed them in a long piece of PVC pipe cut in half as a trough.
Okay.
So I made it so you couldn't even see the feed under the pepper. You could get 5-pound bags of cayenne pepper on Amazon relatively inexpensively.
Okay.
And I would just completely cover it. Once I did that, the birds stopped dying. I never had one. Well, I've only ever had one bird recover, and it still didn't produce a great carcass. It was like a 16-pound turkey, which is a little small for me. But what I did was I had birds stop getting sick. Typically with blackhead, you can expect 90 to 100% fatality, mortality. But with me feeding cayenne pepper in that first year, I kept it to about 50%. And then in the following year, I started feeding them cayenne pepper right out of the gate, and I still kept it to about 50%. So not every bird, I guess the cayenne pepper doesn't work on every bird, right? Some of the birds are maybe weaker from the start.
Yeah.
And more susceptible, weaker immune systems. I don't know. I do notice that it seems to happen. It affects the female birds more than the male, just in my observation, which is good for a meat standpoint because you're culling your smaller birds anyway. But I would rather lose less, right? So,
yeah.
So either way, the cayenne pepper definitely helps. And this year I'm going to try some other things in, I'm going to run 3 different groups, a control group, a cayenne pepper group, and a oregano oil group in the water to see if that will help too. Both the oregano oil and the cayenne pepper are supposed to create a gut biome where the parasite doesn't want to be, right? So the bird will pass it prior to it being able to eat through the cecum, get into the bloodstream, travel to the liver, and then ultimately destroy the liver, destroying the bird.
So I'll just real quick for the audience, tell you guys how I know about birds and cayenne pepper. I pay attention to like business stuff. And about 25 years ago, I remember seeing this product in a store that sold like outdoor stuff, like bird feeders and stuff. And it was to keep the squirrels from raiding your bird feeder. And all it was a big ass bag, like you were saying, a cayenne pepper. And it said, if you just like mammals and capsaicin, bad, burn, hurt, right? And then birds, it doesn't affect them at all. But my favorite part of that was the warning on it. It said, remember, you too are a mammal.
Right? Yeah.
When you're playing with 5 pounds of cayenne, you got to be careful, right? That's where you look at your buddy, you go, hey, man, you got something right there on your eye.
For real. Sometimes that'll happen to me when I'm cutting up peppers from the garden. I'll forget it's on my fingers, and I'll rub my face, and then it's just there.
Why is it such a difficult disease to prevent? Are there other effective treatments or management, or, you know, is the oregano oil and the cayenne so far like the only thing you found? We had somebody here ask if DE would help, and I really don't think that it would, given how DE works.
Yeah. So this isn't, you know, I don't know if the worm has chitin. You know, this is a relatively small, I believe even largely microscopic organism. The eggs are big enough that a turkey will peck them out of the soil. But no, I don't know that DE would work. I would certainly try it if I thought it would. I have no problem. I mean, that's probably not economical to try and cover my fields with diatomaceous earth, but it may be inside like their coop area. The problem is I move them daily. So I could put it in their food, but eating it, I don't think would have any effect at all for the birds.
No, then you need like the dietary Because, like, I think there's different grades of it. Maybe it doesn't matter if it's a turkey.
As the bird digested it, I don't know that it would impact the parasite.
Yeah, I don't think it would. So. Because they say, like, when you use it, like, in a garden or something for pests, like, if it rains, you got to redo it.
Yeah, like, it's essentially a physical barrier for crawling insects. Yeah. That's my understanding anyway.
Are there any other ways to deal with it?
So you can't – there's no sprays, right? Again, as I mentioned before, I wouldn't spray my fields anyway. So I do grass-fed beef, and then I do pastured broilers in one pasture and pastured turkeys in another. So – number one recommended mitigation strategy is never put turkeys and chickens in the same spot, because the chicken allows that pest to proliferate. It takes it from maybe 1% population to 1,000% population, right? So, because the chicken isn't affected, the chicken doesn't die, so it can just eat it and shit it out and eat it and just keep on going, right? And totally help it spread and cover more ground and procreate. So, keep your turkeys away from your chickens. I know a lot of people run mixed flocks and have no problem at all. So, and I did too until I had a problem. So there's nothing I would spray if you could spray anything, and there's nothing that I've been able to find that people spray anyway. It does primarily affect pastured, turkey raisers, because the earthworms are a factor. The pecking off the ground is a factor. So you don't find a lot of chicken houses or turkey houses that have blackhead problems. Mm. They have other problems, but blackhead isn't one of them, because they're usually very biosecure areas. They don't have access to it. There's nothing pharmaceutical that's approved. There's all kinds of anti-protozoans, antifungals people have tried. None of it's approved for birds that you want to eat, though. If I had a pet turkey that was like my buddy or something, I would try a drug if I thought it would save his life, but that's because I'm not going to eat him, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, for a food turkey, there's no approved pharmaceutical solution, and I probably wouldn't use it if there was.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, the only thing that would immediately spring to my mind would be something like an ivermectin or something. But my guess is it's probably not, like, ivermectin's a great antiparasitic, but it's not for all parasites. So,
right. I know people use ivermectin on cows and pigs. My pigs get ivermectin at the farrier before I get them, so that I get a worm-free pig, right? So, in all my research, which is years deep at this point, never have I seen ivermectin even recommended. So maybe it's just not effective on that particular protozoa.
Yeah, it's a totally different, like, you know, cows and pigs are a lot closer to humans than a turkey is. I know that sounds weird, but they are. Pigs are definitely closer to us because they're monogastric.
Yeah, monogastric, exactly.
Yeah. Instead of accepting losses, you started experimenting on your own. What observations led you to believe there might be a practical solution worth investigating?
So again, It was really, like, I guess, an emotional driving force at first, right? My turkeys were dying, and I didn't want that to happen anymore, right? It's not even – the financial loss sucks, too, because I do raise meat birds for turkey – or, you know, for Thanksgiving. But when I was out there and found –
CJ, real quick, just roll. I'll be right back. I got to put this damn dog out.
All righty. So when I was out there with the turkeys, I found that immediately upon feeding the cayenne pepper – the turkeys ate it without any kind of resistance, no apparent, like, the spice didn't bother them, just like we said before. Within a day, I was losing turkeys at about one a day. So every day I'd come out, there'd be another sad, droopy turkey. As soon as I started feeding peppers, I came out, and while the previously sad turkeys were still sad, there were no additional sad turkeys. And once a turkey starts looking sad, you got like a day or two, and then you're going out to find a dead turkey in the morning. It's very fast, because once they start looking sad, it's already into their liver. And then you're just waiting on their liver to fail at that point. Like I said, I had one bird recover, and that still wasn't a great carcass. It just lived. So the pepper must have driven it out somehow, but it never recovered, you know, back to its vigor.
So, I mean, like I said, when I did some research on this and I looked at what a liver looks like, it's awful. And eventually when a liver fails, you get multi-system organ failure and there's just nothing you can do.
Yeah, nothing's filled.
Literally called a liver, as in you need it to live, right?
I mean, makes sense.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was. So that's basically, you know, the driving force was I wanted to try. I was willing to try anything that would still allow me to, you know, let the birds achieve their purpose of Thanksgiving turkeys, and then stop losing them. And fortunately, the cayenne pepper, it's not like you bite into the turkey at Thanksgiving and it tastes like a spicy turkey. None of that affects the meat whatsoever.
No, that makes sense. You know, and it's a pretty big loss too for someone that's farming for profit, not just a homesteader, because they're valuable. I mean, when I did it, I didn't even process them. I had a deal like you come here, first serve, pick your bird, take it away and deal with it out. Like we have a processor about 15 miles away, or you can do it yourself or whatever. And even doing that, you know, like I just put on the air, hey, if you're local, I've got like 26 turkeys this year that I'm going to sell and keep four back. And they were gone and like that quick. They were reserved like by now. And people were picking them up for processing, like, you know, maybe a month before Thanksgiving.
Turkeys are pretty easy to sell.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They're easy to sell. They weigh a lot, and they sell for a premium. So if you lose 100% of a flock,
yep,
then you've already got the money into the poults, feeding them for however long they last and all. It hurts.
Plus, so I've done a lot of investing into turkeys, especially this year. Now a lot of that's funded through a grant through Northeast SARE, which we'll probably talk about later.
Okay.
But that was you know, that's really helping me to get some good infrastructure. So like I said, I'm running three groups this year. One's a control group. They're not gonna get any cayenne or any oregano oil. They're just gonna get, you know, natural grazing, lots of grasshoppers and regular old non-GMO feed, but no special treatment. I expect high mortality in that group.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'll have the cayenne pepper group and the oregano oil group. I don't know what's going to happen with the oregano oil group. I've never tried it. Like I said, anecdotally online have had good results. Cayenne pepper, I've had multiple years of experience now. I know I'm going to have about 50% mortality, but you know, I also have some other factors that I really can't figure, right? So chickens have not been in this pasture now for 3 years.
Okay.
3 years is the estimated life cycle of the survivability of the eggs in an undisturbed field. But what I have had is turkeys, which are possibly propagating this and kicking the can down the road a year for these guys, right? So I don't know. All I know is I'm never putting chickens back in that field, just turkeys and cows. And I'm going to have my three groups. But what I was getting at was, I now have three. I was using cheap Amazon dog kennels to keep the hawks off of them. And I would just screw that to a pressure treated 2x4 square of lumber and drag them around with a rope manually. Right. And that was fine. It worked. But it's also labor intensive, especially going uphill. So this year I bought aluminum with welded wire and tarped purpose-built turkey shelters, 10x12. I bought three of them. They're like $3,000 a piece, so they are not cheap. It'll take me actually 3 years to profit enough off the turkeys to pay them off, but they'll last me 10 or more years.
Yeah.
So it made sense, and I was able to buy them mostly with money through a grant. So now the expense is you know, lessened significantly that way too. I would recommend, you're right, turkeys are easy to sell. They sell themselves. They're a niche product for Thanksgiving. Like, you don't want a grocery store butterball, you want a pastured broad-breasted turkey, then you buy it from a local farmer. People are willing to pay a significant premium for that bird. So I might have probably $40, maybe $45 into a bird, not counting infrastructure. That's just the poult, because I buy high-end poults too, but that's the poult. And then all the feed it's going to consume over the course of its life, which is a lot. That's still, I sell that bird for probably, well, I sell them for $6.50 a pound. So it's going to be, you know, a profit. Now I got to factor in labor, but a profit of like $70 a bird. That's significant.
Yeah, it is.
So, yeah, you know, especially when you got 20 or 30 of them out there, it's certainly enough that you can now file a Schedule F. You can be considered a viable farm in the eyes of the government, and you can start taking advantage of a whole lot of other opportunities.
Grants, loans, et cetera, kind of like we talked about last week. Yeah.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So, here's the thing. Like you mentioned the SARE grant. That actually is my next question in my notes. You received this grant from the SARE Farmer Grant and to study the issue. What exactly are you testing, and you know, kind of how are you going to conduct the study, and what are you hoping to learn over the next 3 years? I mean, you kind of laid out already, you got this control group, they get nothing. You got your pepper group, you got your oregano oil group. I'm guessing that would be like year one, because you don't know what the oregano oil is going to do, but then maybe
it could be nothing
here. Then you can combine, right?
Yes, sir. So what I'm doing is it's a pretty rigorous scientific study. It is farmer, you know, farmer led. I'm the leader. Now, if you've ever heard of Mike Badger, he's the former president of APA, which is the American Pastured Poultry Producers Association, and he currently publishes the APA Grit. He's my technical advisor. So to get a SARE grant, you need a technical advisor, or they won't even consider your application. It has to be someone that – it doesn't have to be like someone from academia. It just has to be a professional in the region you want to study, right? So fortunately, he was gracious enough to agree to participate. He also lives here in Pennsylvania, so that's convenient. He can pop by the farm and see my methods if he wants to. But we're going to take soil samples. They're not going to tell me anything about the parasite. But at least what I'll be able to show is kind of an added bonus to the research is what I expect to be improved soil conditions year over year over year after running turkeys over this ground. Certainly, I'm going to see increased nitrogen. But that's part one of the research. Part two is the three control groups. They are going to follow a known path. So I have a Google Earth map of my pasture, and I'm just going to keep them in this lane. It'll be very easy to do. And they're going to spend 3 months on pasture. So they're in the brooder for a month. They're on the field for 3 months, and then they get butchered at 4 months old. In that time, I'm going to weekly weigh each bird. I'm going to put leg bands on them so I can tell who's who. And then each week I'll be able to weigh them. That will give me data. Like, even though a bird may not be showing symptoms, if I see all of a sudden a plateau or a drop in weight, even though feed consumption is the same, then I'm going to be able to say, hey, this bird's probably sick. Mm-hmm. And then maybe I'll be able to identify some early symptomatic presentations that otherwise I wouldn't see because I wouldn't recognize that the bird was a pound lighter today than he was like 2 days ago, right? So that'll be a benefit. I'm going to keep kind of tabs. I'm going to keep a very, very, very rigorous journal. I'm going to keep tabs on each bird if they show any kind of oddity versus their brethren, right? So if I see a bird that's acting off, I'm going to start to keep very rigorous notes on that particular bird in each control group so that we can start to build a profile of what a blackhead affected bird looks like even before they have yellow droppings.
Yeah, that'd be interesting, because I'll tell you, just from my own limited experience, their growth rate is insane.
Oh yeah.
And if you're doing regular weigh-ins, you're going to very quickly ID one that's falling behind its cohorts. Now,
yep.
Gobblers and hens grow at different rates, but you can account for that.
Certainly. They should both be on the same kind of, if I were to graph it, right, they should be on the same path, the same parabola, right? So if one starts to plateau or lose weight, obviously there's a problem. And then that's when I'm going to start saying, all right, what's weird about this bird? Maybe it's, I don't know, its feathers looked, who knows, right?
Yeah,
so whatever oddity I can identify, I'll log it. Then we're going to process all the birds. I'm going to necropsy all the livers, every single one, to say maybe this bird was sick but got better and never presented. And if that's in the oregano oil group, then I know, hey, the oregano oil seems to be a much better preventative than the cayenne pepper, where once they present, they die.
Yeah.
And who knows? This is all speculation, right? I'll know in November.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's going to be very detailed research. Then I'm going to weigh out all the birds and I'm going to sell them and buy poults next year. I'm going to do it 3 years in a row. We'll have 3 years of data. And again, the benefit of using Northeast SARE is not only are they're very competitive grants, but once you get one, and this is my second one, I was on your show before, like a year or two ago, we turned a big chunk of woods into a silvo pasture using pigs.
Yeah.
And improved out that methodology. So that was under a SARE grant as well. But I was able to buy a bunch of equipment. I'm able to pay myself a labor rate so I'm not, I'm not losing money.
You're your research assistant, right?
Exactly. Exactly. So I'm able to pay myself a labor rate, and then if a bird dies, I expect I'm going to have some birds die. If a bird dies, Sarah is going to pay for me to ship that bird to a local veterinarian here. They're going to perform a professional necropsy with a full report, get it back to me, validate that it's histaminiasis, all that stuff, right? Okay. And then they're also paying for the soil sampling. So the entire project is covered within the confines of the grant, which is pretty awesome.
That's great. I love that you're doing that. In fact, you're trying to answer this question scientifically instead of just relying on like the internet and the wonderful advice that you get from the internet. Oh, just give them Comfrey or something. Yeah. Hey, wait a minute. That might help. Anyway.
Who knows? I don't have any growing here. I'd try it.
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, or biochar, right? That's my solution to everything. Biochar, Azolla, and Comfrey.
I do put biochar into my pig feed. Uh-huh. And they eat it readily. They seem to like it. Like I don't think if I threw just a pile out there, they'd mess with it too much, but they don't filter it out of their feed as they're eating. They eat it right along with the rest and don't seem to dislike it, I guess is a better way to phrase it.
Yeah. Cows will eat it. I mean, they'll pick up a chunk of it, but cows will eat anything. And to their own detriment, I've seen cows try to kill themselves on eating enough acorn to give them tannic acid poisoning. I've seen cows try to kill themselves by eating the Osage oranges to the point where they start to get clogged up. I mean, a cow is a walking death sentence to itself if you let it. But so you talk to a pig farmer and say describe pigs and they're like unpredictable, smart, and dangerous. And you talk to a cattle farmer and he says, yeah,
dumb,
unpredictable, dangerous, and stupid.
Yeah. Right? Like, I see all kinds of videos. So fortunately, my cows are pretty docile, but I've seen videos with they're walking around with like a gate on their head or a feeder on their head. And they're very funny.
So can you talk a little bit, like coming at this scientifically, why is farmer-led research so important? And how can ordinary farmers produce data that's actually useful like this? Because I don't think this is a problem you solve in a lab, right?
No, because
doesn't work that way.
Because, and the lab would have to be like maybe Rodale or something where they have access to significant pasture land. But I believe that by, farmers doing the research, you still need to kind of have some scientific rigor. You need to record good data. You need to have a plan. You need to stick to your plan. But I'm not a scientist, right? So I'm not going to be predisposed to think of like, this won't work because this journal said so 10 years ago, right? I don't know. I don't have access to that. So I'm going to try things that maybe haven't been tried or maybe people would scoff at. And maybe I have a better result that can be helpful to other laymen on their farms, especially people like me doing, 50 or less birds a year, turkey wise. You're not big enough for academia to really take an interest in you. So the scientific community is going to be much more worried about saving a turkey house, where you have, 20,000 turkeys on a multi-house farm. That's a significant financial impact. If my birds die, it sucks, but no one's hurting from it,
Yeah. So you're hurting, but nobody else is.
Exactly. And maybe my customers, right? But I think through farmer-led research, not only do we have the network, the communities on YouTube or Discord or everywhere else where people are just sharing ideas and talking, which has been, a lot of my inspiration and methodology has come from YouTube. So, watching Salatin videos and things like that, right? So it seems seems common, but it's super helpful, and that's why it's common. So I think that the more farmers doing this, the better. And I think, you know, farmers should pursue opportunities like I did with the SARE grant, because that is, you know, it's $26,000. It's a little more than that, actually, over the course of 3 years. That's not chump change to someone that's, you know, starting a farm. That's a big deal. And that's money that you don't have to pay back. You got to pay taxes on it, but you don't have to pay it back. And you just have to do what you said you're going to do with it. So I would, you know, I would recommend to anybody to pursue farmer-led research grants, because you're going to answer valuable questions. Even if I find out from this project that cayenne pepper and oregano oil have zero effect, that's still valuable information. It's one thing that people know, hey, this doesn't work. We need to maybe try something else.
And it's been proven that it doesn't work, or, you know, right. Definitely. It also is the case, you know, I just feel like a lot of the big academic community would look at this and go, well, you know, it's not a problem in a turkey house, so why are you doing it in a pasture, right? Like, that's, those people don't think
different
the world that real people live in. They think in this very sterile environment. You know, my niece actually went to college at Texas A&M. She has a degree in poultry science, and she's a wonderful person. And she's actually not using her degree, but just, you know, we talked to her and her, one of her classmates, when they graduated, we went down there for it. And I'm not putting them down or anything. I'm just saying that, you know, like my wife, after we talked to them for a while, said we know more about, you know, chickens and ducks and turkeys than they do. And they have a degree from a very prestigious ag university in poultry science. And to me, it's yes, we do, but no, we don't. Like, we know what we know and they know what they know. But what they know is all optimized for, you know, factory production style agriculture.
Certainly.
And so, you know, if they're going to work out, you know, feed medication ratios and stuff, like, I'm sure they can do things I wouldn't even recognize the algebra in it, but it doesn't pertain to people who are trying to grow food naturally at all. And I'll let you answer that and roll. I've got the damn dog barking at me again.
Yep. Gotcha. Right, they're raising birds on margin. And small farms don't operate on margin. I mean, margins are important, but that shouldn't be your main concern. Eking out 1 or 2%. You need to be marketing your stuff as superior to the grocery store product, because it is. And you should be able to quantify that and demonstrate that through your methods, through the taste of your meat. When if someone isn't ready to buy a chicken from you, then give them a chicken, and they'll buy more chicken in the future, because they will see the quantifiable difference. So, the chicken house and the research that would be supported by a chicken house farmer is totally different than what we're trying to do on a pasture at a little more than a homestead scale, but certainly a small scale farm. I might have $40,000 of revenue a year, which is extremely small in agriculture.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, everybody's got to start somewhere, and solving these problems is how we get more people doing this. Cause like, it is a great niche, and I don't think we're in any danger of oversupplying the niche of pastured turkey.
No, not a chance.
Because I do get calls occasionally, cause we did them before, and our site has some pictures of them. We never sold them online or anything. And we'll get a call, you know, we'll get calls in like September. Like, I want to get one for Thanksgiving. And they're like, well, we don't do that. Well, can you tell me who does? Well, I can. And maybe you could order one for next year. Like, by September, you can forget it. Like, they're gone. Like you said, they sell themselves.
Yeah, in March is when I take deposits for my November turkeys. Yep.
As soon as they hit the ground, you have people throwing money at you. I mean, it's you know, and if you could raise $100,000 that way, that probably wouldn't be the case anymore. But you can't.
Certainly.
You're not going to. To me, they're one of the most underrated things for farmers to run, and that's why, like, I was excited to get you on, because I just never heard of this illness before. We believe at one point we had a problem with some avian tuberculosis in our ducks. And if you get that, it's nothing like human tuberculosis. It's much quicker acting. And when we like did an autopsy on them, the way that liver looks, everything, the lungs, the liver, the kidney, it all looks like that. Some of the stuff just almost like falls apart, you know, after they die when you open them up. And I mean, when you open them up really, like you find them the next morning and that's what it's like. It's kind of devastating to lose an animal that way, especially when you have money into it and when it's, you know, a high resale product. And if you're taking deposits like that, then you're off, not only just not making the money, you're refunding deposits.
Yeah, I've had to do that. I had to do that on chickens. This heat wave that we just had wiped out. In 1 hour, I lost 60 chickens. And then my wife and I were able to – I have them out in the field, and I've had 100-degree days before, and I might lose a chicken.
Yeah.
Everyone else just laid down, panted, and was fine, right? But this was just 3+ 100-degree days back-to-back. In the, they're shaded. They're in chicken tractors, tall ones, the Siskovich style. So plenty of ventilation, but it just wasn't enough. The air wasn't moving. So anyway, within an hour, we lost 60 chickens. My wife and I were hand carrying the chickens to the shade, and then I put a big industrial fan on them. And as soon as I did that, that little 10-degree drop or whatever, they stopped dying. But, you know, that was catastrophic. Because I only started with 150, and then I had a fox come in, clean me out. This has been a bad year for chickens. I never had predation problems, and I never had heat stroke. But I ended up only butchering about 80 chickens out of my 150, which is terrible. And I had to give a bunch of people their deposits back.
That hurts.
It sucks. And it sucks more that, like, I'm in it to make money, but it sucks more that I was responsible for those animals, right? Same thing with the turkeys, right? Now, the turkeys is kind of beyond my control. I'm going to find ways to mitigate blackhead. That's the whole point. But, so when they die, I guess I don't feel personally responsible. It wasn't my failure. It's something that's in my soil, and I'm not going to stop raising birds. I'm going to figure out how to work with my soil. But with those chickens, had I known what I know now, I could have moved them to the shade the day before, and then I wouldn't have lost any.
I'm just my engineering brain is thinking of smaller fans run by direct solar panels and wondering if
just to move air.
Just to move air. Because what happens is those, like you said, you use a taller model chicken tractors, but you still build heat under there. And one thing about birds is birds produce heat.
They do. When I was picking them up off the ground, it didn't burn my hands, but their bellies were hot.
I had a friend of mine one time that was big into quail back when I was getting into quail that brought me some chicks, and the heat in the box, and it was winter time, you know, and I'm like, did you put like a warm pack in there for them? Or she's like, no, that's just their
bird heat.
And so if you could move that heat out, it may be helpful. And one of the hard things is you're tractoring, and I understand why you have to, because you got predators. And that always compounds the heat effect. Like, we used to have free range chickens when we did have a few. And when it would get really hot, like, my wife would take like a 1 gallon ice tea jug and throw it in the freezer full of water. And we would set a couple out in the grass, and they would literally back up to it and like stick their ass up against it. But, you know, you can't do that with hundreds of birds and tracks.
Yeah, no, it wouldn't have worked. But the fan was the answer. So as soon as I got them out of the direct sunlight, now they were under a white tarp, right?
Yeah, I got you.
But still out of the direct sunlight, under the shade of a big oak tree, and with a huge industrial fan, I basically lined up the, I had some spare tractors. I lined them up and made like a wind tunnel.
Yeah.
And immediately they stopped dying. So that was the answer. But now I know if I'm going to have another heat wave here, move into the shade the day before.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's what I can do.
Yeah.
Fortunately, when I'm raising my turkeys, they're in the, they want 100 degrees right now. You know, I got them, I only got them 2 days ago. They're 2 day old pulps. So they're under the heat lamp, even though it's 90 degrees outside. And they'll go out into the field in mid-August. I'm not going to be worried about temperature mid-August forward. I'm not going to get 100-degree days. At least I hope not.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets hotter in middle – like, it gets hotter in September here.
I hope that doesn't happen here.
It's about the third or fourth week of September. It levels off and starts to actually decline in October. The hobbits come in August and throw – rings in the backyard to get rid of them.
Yeah.
It's pretty brutal. It's actually not been that bad this year, and then now we're hitting like a multi-day stretch of like 105s.
You're getting hotter. We got cooler. It's in the 80s.
I think it finally like let the heat come. Like, you guys have had heat trapped up north. Everybody's talking about how hot it is this year. I'm like, what are you guys talking about? We had, you know, days in June that topped out in the mid to upper 80s. That doesn't happen here. Like, that's overnight lows here.
Right, usually. Right. Yeah. I totally understand.
But, for someone who wants to raise a few turkeys on pasture, what practical steps do you recommend to reduce the risk here? If you're growing 100 of them or 50 of them for market and you lose half of them, that hurts. But with that level of mortality, I mean, if somebody's growing four for themselves, they can lose them all really easy.
Certainly. And then you got nothing. So number one would be don't have turkeys on ground that you've had chickens on in the last 3 years, right? So I know a lot of people run mixed flocks, and I'll get back to what I said earlier, but it's not a problem until it's a problem. And once it is a problem, you're not getting rid of it. It's going to be there. Like, I'm not trying to find ways to eradicate this from my soil. I wish there was a way. I'm trying to find ways to work with it now that it's there. And people will be in the same spot, right? So number one, keep your chickens and your turkeys separate. Number two would be incorporate a little bit of cayenne pepper into their feed from the minute they're out of the brooder. In the brooder, you're not going to have a problem because they don't have access to, you know, they're probably just on wood chips or whatever you keep in your brooder. They don't have access to the worms, to the eggs. I bleach my brooder just with a little squirt bottle of bleach water solution. I don't worry about it with the chickens. Chickens are very rugged, but with the turkeys, they're just fragile little guys, right? So I missed everything. I use the same brooder for chickens and turkeys. So I missed it with a bleach water. I let it sit for a day. That's going to kill anything topical that probably wasn't there anyway. Okay. And then, so a little bit of cayenne pepper as soon as your birds are outside. And then just, I keep an eye out. You know, if you see yellow droppings, you're probably going to see a sad bird before you see yellow droppings. But if you see yellow droppings, find the bird and then separate them. Because another important thing that we didn't mention yet is it's called cloacal drinking. But, you know, the cloaca is the bird's vent.
Yeah.
What they'll do, so they don't have to eat the egg or the worm to get this. They'll sit in the shit of another turkey and suck up the disease through their cloaca. And now that's given it like a direct shot into their intestinal tract where they can just become immediately affected. That's actually one of the main transmission ways. So these coops I was talking about that I bought have roosting bars. In the past, I haven't allowed the turkeys to roost. I just had them sleep on the ground. By sleeping on roosting bars, we'll see how long they last because these are thin aluminum bars. I think eventually I'm going to come out there and just find a collapsed roosting bar. But
yeah.
I get big turkeys. But by roosting and not sleeping on the ground, that should limit the guys that are basically sucking it up.
Butt sucking for real, right?
Yeah, exactly. So
Amy says, I'm now fully grossed out. That says something. Amy's a farm girl. She's not afraid of stuff like this.
Yeah, well, I guess look, Google cloacal drinking. You'll see all about it.
So that's interesting. First, I know that they love to roost. And so they're probably happier anyway, but keeping them off the ground, and when you're tractoring them, there's a magnified effect of that fecal spread.
Certainly. Although I move them sometimes twice a day.
I was wondering, like, just would increasing that even possibly be more effective? Because I'm wondering, like, what if you took two farms about the same size, raising about the same amount of turkeys, and one was free ranging and one was tractoring, there might be a marked difference there. But like you said, like when you have these freaking goshawks flying around that you have, they'll take a 15-pound bird.
They will. Like, the red tails won't really mess with turkeys.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got goshawks and they'll take a poult. But once that bird's up to about 6 pounds, they're like,
as big as the hawk. Yeah, exactly.
But the problem, so the hawk is like, well, I can kill it, but then I can't carry it.
Right.
So I got
to stay down there on the
ground, and that's not good because these big furry things come and eat me. So they don't want to do it, right?
So originally we did. I would give them a chicken tractor with the door open, just so they had a place to go to get out of the rain, and then I would run poultry net around it in a pretty large area, and my turkeys did free range. Then I did that for a year or two, and I didn't have this problem, right? I didn't have any blackhead, and I didn't have the hawks. Then I had the hawks, so I brought the birds in and consolidated them. Then I had the blackhead problem. Huh. So who knows? The hawks could have been the cause of me putting the turkeys in this bad situation. I expect that you're right. If I was able to free range them, I probably would have a lot less mortality because the birds are spending less time near their feces.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Or so I move them twice a day.
Even if you weren't letting them full free range, the model you had giving them a much larger area.
Yeah, probably like a tenth of an acre, right? So they're spreading it out over a huge area for them.
There's a big wolf-looking furry blonde white dog in there with them. That might, but you know, that's another animal to take care of. And
yeah, and my wife would never allow me to. We had a Pyrenees, and it stayed in the house.
Okay.
We are not outside dog people. I would do it, but I wouldn't be allowed to do it.
Yeah. I mean, if there was some way to get rid of the hawk problem, that might be another avenue. But I know from where you're from, I know exactly what you're talking about. It's like a freaking eagle hawk.
Yeah, they're huge. Know? I have these beach balls. And it's got like a big, it's got eyeballs. It's supposed to look like an owl, I guess.
Yeah.
Like a big owl. I hung them all over the place. I have noticed less red tails, and I haven't seen the goshawks this year, but that doesn't mean that they're scared away. They migrate. So it could
They didn't have anything to eat anymore. Yeah, that's why left. As soon as the dinner bell's back on, they'll come back.
So, yeah. But I will. So. I think you're right. I just don't have a way to test it. If I was free ranging the turkeys, I think I'd have less mortality.
I don't think it works that way. I just think you maybe have less.
Yeah. If one ate a worm with those eggs in it and it was in the control group, or the cayenne pepper or the oregano oil proved ineffective, then I'm probably still going to have a sick turkey. Yeah. But, one of my mitigation strategies in this research project is I'm going to have a pretty low stocking density. I have 10 by 12 coops. I'm only putting 15 birds in there. So that's almost 10 square feet per bird. If my math jives there, maybe a little less. Either way, it is a ton. It's way more than a turkey wants because they like to bunch up anyway, right? I could give them a huge space and they're all going to hang out together regardless. So I have low stocking density, frequent moves. I'm going to do everything I can to keep them off their feces. And I'm going to try these, you know, non-pharmaceutical mitigations, and we'll see what the results are.
It'll be really interesting if this year you get a positive variable for both the oregano oil and the cayenne, and then can transition next year into
trying both
the combination, right? Because now you don't need you've already proven that both have a mitigating effect. So now you don't need really a control so much anymore. You can go to a three spreader. I don't know.
I'd be able to do that, I guess, 3 years from now, but I've entered into an agreement that I will run a 3-year trial of these
exact same way.
Yes.
Okay.
To gather kind of consistent data.
Yeah.
So if I lose birds, which I expect to lose birds, especially from the control group, that's just part of the research. That's why I'm only selling 30 of my 45 turkeys. Right. So, If some of the control lives, cool. If not, it was expected that they were going to struggle.
You know, I guess the other thing you could do if you just wanted to, you'd have
my own little flock off to the side.
You could add a fourth, right? Certainly. You could add a fourth as a combo, because then you're still fulfilling your obligation to the grant.
And I could let those guys free range. So the combo of cayenne, oregano oil, and poultry net, if the hawks aren't a problem, if I don't lose any birds, well then here, anecdotally, try this. All together, and you're probably going to
give me more
success.
Money, and I'll do it proper the next one,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you know, I will keep applying for grants. I'm pretty good at it, and it's led to a lot of infrastructure I might not have been able to get. So I will.
Yeah, I think we
will definitely
need
keep
to
that
talk
up.
More about that. You actually were on the show previously. It was episode 3541, and we talked specifically about grants. So it was almost exactly 2 years ago, actually. It was August of 2024.
Wow.
We talked about that. Can you maybe say a little bit more about that? How did that experience in running that grant lead you maybe to this one? And what advice would you give to someone who has a good idea but assumes grants are for, you know, universities and large farms and things like that?
Right. So I would say that, right, the answer is they're not just for universities and large farms. They certainly do take advantage of them, and they're probably – they're dealing with like $1 million grants, right? Which you're not going to have access to. But that was a good title on that slide because it is a government grant. In the end, it is through Northeast SARE, which is an academic association based out of the University of Vermont, but the money is USDA money. So the grant is a government funded grant ultimately. It's just, you know, that it's an award, a large award given to the University of Vermont North through Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education to distribute according to their application to get the money in the first place, right? So I'm extremely thankful to them. Again, this is the second grant I've been awarded. Working with them is always a positive experience, but I also uphold my end of the bargain. You know, I will do X with your money, and then I do X. I would tell people to apply. There's so SARE is regional. I'm in the Northeast region, obviously in Pennsylvania, but they cover the entire continental United States. So you would be able to, whatever state you're in, find your region of SARE and apply for the farmer grants. They usually throw out their calls for proposals, I want to say like late in the year, November or something. You have all your Christmas break, et cetera, to kind of think it over, come up with an idea, walk around your farm or walk around your homestead. You do have to be, all right, your homestead still has to be, you have to be a farmer. You don't have to be profitable, but you do have to have agricultural income to apply for the grant. There's some grants that you don't, but most of them you do, which is why it's important to file a Schedule F, right? To kind of come full circle, raise a couple turkeys. If you raise 10 turkeys, you're going to have, if you raise 10 turkeys to butcher, you will have $1,000 of income, which is the USDA definition of what a farm is, right? It doesn't have to be profit, just income. Now you can file a Schedule F, and now you can prove to all these grant organizations that you are a legitimate concern, and the number of grants you can apply to, it's astronomical, right? You go from like 1 to 100. So I would apply for all of them. Come up with a problem and then develop a solution and then put it into words, and you won't regret it. So I would tell people to check out SARE, check out, you could just Google agricultural grants in my area, and you're going to get a long list. Look into all of them. 90% of them are going to be legitimate opportunities. Most of them probably aren't available right now because we're in the award season, but the application season starts around Thanksgiving.
Okay. And that makes sense. And, you know, I would tell people that, one, there are – now, with a smaller grant, you may not find this as much, but there are people who literally make a living off writing grants. And so that's always possible. But the other thing is you don't really need that.
Not at all.
We talked a lot about how to write a grant on your last episode, if I remember right. But we didn't have anywhere near the developed level that we do of AI now. And the little crit action there, context, role, interview, task, you know, context, I am a farmer, this is my situation, this is what I'm trying to do, role. You are an expert in writing agricultural grants for small farms with revenue between $25,000 and $100,000 in the pig space or whatever it is,
certainly,
right?
Certainly.
And then ask me 5 questions one at a time to better understand my situation. Task, advise me of the proper way and, you know, high points of what to hit on writing my grant. And you can accelerate a great deal that way, I would believe.
For sure. I would, so that is very sound advice, but I would do it exactly how you said. Use the CRIT method, because so I've sat on grant review panels too, and I can very clearly identify a grant application where somebody simply took, like, they pulled the, they screenshotted the grant application off their computer, threw it into ChatGPT and said, get me grant. Yeah. And it spits out like a bunch of nonsense that really it's not cohesive. It doesn't. So each grant is going to very clearly define their rules. Like, if you want our money, here's what we're giving money away for. Here's who you need to be. And here's what you need to do with it. You need to make sure that you're addressing those rules. If you're specific with your prompts, AI is going to give you a good result. It probably won't even be identifiable as AI anymore. Right. So, yeah, sound advice. And you're going to outcompete just by doing it that way. You're going to outcompete 40% of the pool, right? So now you're only, if they're going to award 40% of the grant applications, you only got a 20% margin that you have to beat at that point. You've already ruled out the ash and trash. So yeah. And they did for the 5 minutes it'll take you working with ChatGPT or whatever. If it nets you even a micro award of say $200, that's $200 you didn't have, right? And if it's under $600, they're not even going to make you fill out a 1099. So, you know, that's literally free money.
Yeah, and I always get kickback and pushback from this, what I call special libertarians, when we talk about grants and things like this. And I have had the same rule since I started this show in 08. My rule goes back further than that when it comes to money from the government. I will worry about that the day that I am net positive. Right. Yeah, as long as I am net negative out of pocket into the government, all I'm doing is taking my stolen money back. And I don't know what kind of libertarian doesn't understand that, but they exist. And when you talk like this, they come out from under rocks and they wipe their eyes off and they yell at you. It doesn't bother me, guys. You can yell all you want.
I was going to say, just ignore them.
And they also say, like, well, then they get their hooks in you or whatever. It's like, what we're talking about here is not really loans. We're talking about grants, which is where they give you the money and then you have to agree to do the thing that the grant says, and then when that is over you don't have to do it anymore. And those terms are clearly disclosed.
You sign a contract.
Yeah, and
at least for the one I'm going.
You don't have like a whole bunch of guys in black suits showing up at your farm all the time now to check on you or something, because that's the other, you know, you now they can come anytime they want or whatever, like.
And they could. So that is in the – no one's going to come down to my farm for Vermont. I would welcome them if they did, because I'd like to show them the grant, right? Yeah, but it's going to be someone from the – it's not going to be a black suit. It's going to be someone from the
– it's not going to be Agent Smith from the freaking Matrix.
And I would welcome them here, and I'd say thank you for the award. Here's what I'm doing with it, right? So I don't worry much about it. I would not enter into an agreement that I thought was going to be detrimental to my farm long term. And my other job, I work for the government, right? So, I don't want to be hypocritical, like saying that I'm not going to take government money when my mortgage is paid with government money. So I would recommend that people pursue every single grant opportunity they can find. Because it's going to jumpstart you. You know, you may not have been willing to spend $1,000 to put a frost-free hydrant in, and you're going to keep carting out buckets and breaking ice and running electric to melt, you know, your horse's water or whatever you're doing with it. Whereas if someone gave you $1,000 but didn't give it to you like, here's $1,000 cash, they said, here's a frost-free hydrant. Oh, by the way, I'm going to pay someone to dig the hole. And all you have to do is, you know, ask for it and then be happy to get it. You're not going to say no unless you're an idiot, right? So, I mean,
we have a few.
Yeah. Well, then they're going to, to their own detriment, right?
Yeah. So, that's okay. Then you don't get it. And most of the people talking that way don't qualify for the things anyway. It's always that's the case. You know, you find out like, what do you do? And it's like, I mow lawns for a living. I live at my mom's house. Like, I'm not taking advice from you anyway. It doesn't matter. Let's stop taking those people. You do farm while holding a full-time military career. How have you managed to build a successful regenerative, you know, livestock operation without farming full-time? And what systems are there that made that possible?
Well, so for instance, I'm on leave today, right? So in the military, you get 30 days of leave a year, which is probably the same as when you were in.
Yep.
So that's fortunate, right? 30 days off is nice. In addition to federal holidays, I get a lot of 4-day weekends to work on my farm. But if it's just a normal day, it means I'm up at like 5:30. I'm out there. I'm checking on the birds. I have a 30-minute drive to work. You know,
you're out of Indian. Are you working out of Indian Town Gap?
Working in Indian Town Gap. Okay, yep.
Cool. Yeah, I do know the area.
Yep. It's the best commute I have. So I've ever had. And so I used to live, I was active duty first, but when I joined the PA Guard, I used to live near Pottstown, which is down closer to Philadelphia, at least relative to where I'm at. Right.
Yeah.
And I worked in Plymouth Meeting, which is near King of Prussia. And then, I got moved, my job moved to Harrisburg. So I was driving 90 minutes one way, which was really not pleasant. Right. But now I live near Hamburg and, work at the Gap. So it's 30 minutes door to door. It's the best commute I've ever had.
It's not a bad drive either.
No, it's 78. It's always against traffic's always going the other way.
Yeah.
So it's a nice drive.
What I'm saying is it's kind of a pretty drive too. It is
all mountains, right, Leon?
Yeah.
You got the mountains off to the right. Sun's always at my back. You know, in the morning it's behind me, in the night it's behind me. But, so I'm up early. I get my chores done. My wife takes care of the farm all day, but that consists of all the heavy lifting is done, right? So she goes, she makes sure no one's torn down a fence, makes sure everybody has water. And then when I come home, I'm usually home by like 5 o'clock, you know, and I only keep animals from like May to October, maybe November. So I got long daylight hours in there. So I'm able to come home and between like 5 and 8, I wrap up the rest of my chores. So that's how I'm able to do it.
Yeah.
Without my army job, I probably couldn't do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Or you'd have to do a hell of a lot more, I guess would be the way. What I like about the whole, like, everybody comes onto the farm and everybody graduates off the farm model is that gives you that winter. You're not doing the heavy lifting work anymore. It also gives you freedom. Like, one of the things I look at here that, you know, makes things like just taking vacations difficult is, you got even a small duck flock. I got about 40 ducks. Somebody has to take care of them.
Right.
Right.
And you need someone reliable.
And it's not just you don't just get your regular person that comes by the house, takes the mail out of the box and throws it on the kitchen table, you know, fills up the cat dish and then goes away and comes back the next day. Or even like somebody off of Rover that can let your dogs out 2 or 3 times a day. Like, you have actual work that has to be done. And if you do it wrong, which they will, things die, right?
Yeah, and you essentially need someone to live there.
Yeah, and that's what we do right now, and it has me rethinking some things because, you know, as we get older, we want to travel more, and I've kind of made that commitment to my wife to do more vacationing, and it gets expensive because what I actually end up doing is paying somebody like $75 a day to couch surf at my house and take care of my animals. And the work's not that hard, but it has to be done.
Right.
And if something things die. Breaks – they either have to be competent enough to fix it or have enough going on up in the brain to go, hey, I need help fixing it.
Right.
You know, and then you can walk them through it. Cause I also have like a lot of aquatic stuff and all. And if it's July and one of those pumps goes off for 6 hours, it's catastrophic.
Yep. So we vacation in the winter.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And that may change when I get out of the Army. I'm only going to do a couple more years. Right. So, that may change. I may change what I do, or I may just have to increase my profitability to factor in a farm sitter for a week in the summer. I don't know. I'll figure all that out when the time comes. But right now, I vacation in the winter.
Something, yeah. You got to get big enough to hire somebody that can just do it when you're not there.
The problem is land acquisition, right? So I'm basically at capacity. I have 14 pigs in the woods. I have 3 beef up in my – I only have 4 acres of pasture, and I run 3 beef on it, which means, especially this year, it's been so dry, I'm feeding hay all summer long, which I haven't had to do before. I've usually – so this is the first year. Yeah, so that's the pasture that I used to free range the turkeys in, and the goshawks used to live in those trees right there. But now the turkeys are in a different pasture.
Yeah.
That shows the stripes from the chicken tractors. But, I'm at capacity. The problem is land, when it comes available, it gets snatched up so fast before it even hits the market that I don't even have a chance to bid. And I probably couldn't afford it if I did have a chance to bid.
Yeah.
You know, we're
How much land do you have total?
So I have 12 acres here.
Okay.
Six of it's in woods, and I use that for pigs.
Yeah.
I'm also going to start putting cows down into the pig woods because of that silvopasture I created. I had like 3-4 foot grass this year, which is perfect. But I, even so, I might be able to go to 4 beef. That would be, you know, the most of what I can do here.
Yeah.
I could increase chickens. I could do a lot more chickens. I just don't want to do a lot more chickens. I'm happy with where I'm at there. The chickens are the most work and the least profit. I still like having chicken in the freezer, but it is a lot of work.
Thanks to Joel, everybody wants to do them. And I'm like, you guys need to do some math, right? Like, because it's already hard to sell a bird for $24, but then go figure out how much money you make out of that.
It's not a lot. I got $17 a feed into a big chicken sometimes. I butcher it 7 weeks. Plus the labor, right? That's twice a day. You're with the chickens twice a day. So I still profit from them, just not as much as I do from a cow. So I would love to do more cows. I need more land. So
you
that
need
might
to
require
hook you up with the mushroom guy from last week.
I listened to that episode. That was a good one.
I have huge clusters right now. I can see through here in my tent of the golden oysters that all the environmental warriors want gotten rid of because they're invasive. And I'm like,
well,
they already did
room.
That. They already did. It's too late. That's done. Like they're not getting from my grow tent to your farm in Virginia or whatever you're worried about. Like,
and they
they're
might already
there
be there.
Already.
Yeah.
If your research confirms what you've already observed, what could that mean for small farmers and homesteaders and the future of pasture-raised turkeys?
So we're going to catalog everything. I'm going to put out an annual report, and the benefit of SARE grants is I saw you threw up the name of the organization there earlier. If somebody goes to their website, they've sponsored thousands of projects over the last several decades, right? All that stuff is public domain. So there's guys out there that have plans for like robotic chicken tractors, you know, with all the schematics to build, you know, whatever drives the wheels and everything else. It would be probably under grants. I'm not sure. Maybe past projects. It's on there. But, you know, my silvopasture project is on there just showing all the soil testing from taking kind of what was before neglected deer woods and running pigs through it. The dramatic improvement in fertility, the grass species that have popped up behind the pigs and felling some trees. But again, thousands and thousands of detailed reports on funded projects here. People could just jump on there and say, hey, I've searched for anything, right? I want to raise ducks, in a pond. I don't know, whatever, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That was a pretty weak example. I'm saying that someone's probably done it, and they've done like, what kind of feeder fish should I put in the pond to support ducks? Or, you know, how do ducks interact with, who knows, right? Just tons of them. So people get on there, they can pull the report, and they can replicate the results on their farm.
Well, you aren't far off raising ducks on a small agroforestry farm. Yeah.
There you go.
So there's an example there for ducks. Marketing options, development of cooperative food distribution models.
So a lot of them are business-based, right? So if you're a small business and you're looking for marketing advice, marketing materials, right? There's templates you can get where you just kind of dump your farm name in there. There's data on what's more profitable, selling direct to consumer or a bunch of farmers markets, right? So the point is the work's been done. USDA's paid for it through SARE, and people should take advantage of all this data. There's so much data here.
I got my brain. I gotta stop. I'll be giving you 100 projects for your life to try to expand it after you're out of the military.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out how do we take the pasture and add trees but not take away the pasture and make money off the trees and make money off the pasture. But that site may be great for people in that situation that are trying to figure out, like, how do I maximize? How do I, you know, expand what I'm doing?
Yeah, and if they're into, like, mushrooms, right? There's tons of myco projects on there. If they're into anything agricultural, even if they're like a row cropper, right? There's row crop stuff on there. So anything they're interested in seeing what other farmers have done. And the other benefit is you cannot, Sarah will not fund a repeat project. So let's say somebody wanted to research blackhead in turkeys in the Northeast region next year. Unless they have a dramatically different project than what I'm doing, it's not going to get funded. It's not even going to be approved because it's already been done. But somebody in Texas could replicate my project exactly and just change the region. And now it is different because birds ain't going to grow. So
it's not a loophole. That's a totally valid thing.
It is. And if you read into the data, it tells you like, you know, you can't replicate a project in the same region, but if you're in a different region, you can try a project that's already been done. It's very clearly stated.
Well, and so, it needs to be, because I can tell you flat out, this where I live and where you live are different. Like when I first planted my first garden down here, not even where I'm at here, but just in this region, I was like, I grew up gardening and I grew all the tomatoes and I grew all the peppers and I grew all the broccoli and I'm just going to throw in a garden. I'm going to grow all the food. And then, yeah, okay. You're going to have to learn some new things. It's not the same. It's just not.
Yeah, I mean, the call for proposals comes out in late fall, early winter. People need to look at that, find out what region they're in. Now, this is just for SARE, right? Other grants are different, right? But for SARE, jump on there. Look at what's been done in your region, and then look to other regions for ideas of what you could do in yours that hasn't been done there yet. That's one way to approach filling out a proposal. Another way would be walk around your farm and identify problems that you're having with whatever. It could be a fencing problem. It could be any number of things, right? And then jump in there, see if someone's done it. If no one's done it, come up with a proposal. Say, here's the question I want to answer. Here's my methodology that I'm going to put into place to try to answer the question. And use ChatGPT. Use it to, at a minimum, use it to proofread. So that you're not putting spelling errors, because when the grant reviewer reads it and like the first 20 words are spelled wrong, they're already in their mind, even though like we're still going to read the proposal, right? And we're going to give it its value, because who knows? Maybe English is your second language or something. It's possible. But you still want to you're going to not do yourself any favors by not having a professional presentation.
Well, and so, I mean, I look at it this way, as if I was judging a proposal. It is very important that the record keeping on this be accurate and specific to detail. And if you don't care enough to proofread
right,
your grant application when you're asking me for $50,000, well, how do I expect?
What's the result going to be? Exactly.
Yeah. You know, like how am I going to then hold this up as an example if you can't spell things right? And I feel a little weak saying that because I spell things wrong all the time, but I'm also not submitting a grant.
There's also tools available now that can spell everything you say, right? So you should not be publishing erroneous spelling unless you simply didn't run it through a spell checker.
Yeah.
You know, so I would tell people
like you write a paragraph and you're like, that's exactly what I want to say, but it's clunky and you just can't unclunk it.
Right,
and it'll unclunk it for you. Use AI to unclunk it, and then you drop it back in, and then maybe you change a thing or two after that. So it is yours. Because if you don't take those kinds of approaches, the problem, like you said earlier, is I look at it and go, ChatGPT wrote this.
And you can tell it's like,
I need to read it. I look at this. It was actually a really interesting study somebody did recently on LinkedIn where it actually showed kind of like the fingerprint of writing patterns, and all the AIs had a fingerprint that kind of looked like a funnel like this. And they were all different, like Claude, GPT, Gemini were all different, but they were all similar. And like the human funnel was more like it started narrow and came down and like hourglassed back down. And it was like, I'm like, I don't really know what they're saying with that diagram because I don't see it that way. I don't know how they're getting that pattern, but I'm like, so, but that has to be what I'm seeing because I just look and there's a certain, I guess it's one of those things like you get experience with things. Like I grow these little shrimps and they're like female, male. And the person sitting next to you goes, I don't see a female, female, male, 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 female, male, male, female. Right. And they all of a sudden click and they get it and you can explain it, but you don't really see it. And that's how AI fingerprints of writing are to me. Like, you just, I feel like the dude in Matrix.
Yep.
Like,
yep.
He's watching all the code coming down. He's like, I just see blonde, brunette, redhead. Like, you could just see it. And I think the average person can see it.
Oh, I'm sure. And so, I mean, there's certain dead giveaways. For instance, ChatGPT doesn't indent on new paragraphs, right?
Yeah.
Most people instinctively, at least older people, instinctively indent on a new paragraph. There's just kind of dead giveaways there, but it's really the way the speech is the biggest clue. Like, it has just a certain flow of its words, and you can identify it easily.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean you can't lean heavily on it, especially for proofreading. Also clarification, because you're going to communicate to a pretty diverse audience, and you want to be able to hit everybody where they want to be, so that you know you have a maximum chance of getting funded. So I would tell everybody, like, come up with your idea, come up with it in your own words, feed it to the program, make sure that if you're going to use AI, make sure it understands the rules of the grant. You could even give it the proposal so it'll know the rules. And then once it spits out your answers, don't just blindly cut and paste them in. Go ahead, reread them, rewrite them, feed them back through one more time, just saying, hey, check spelling. And then you can paste them in. But you're going to have a much higher success rate than someone that puts almost no effort into it.
Cool, man. Well, it's just a couple questions here, and then we'll let you go. Starting off. Survivalizer says, do we know the mechanism of effect if it's the capsaicin? I wonder if it's high dosing, pure capsaicin and feed would be more effective.
So I don't know the truth. I do know that I think it's the capsaicin. What else could it be in cayenne, right? I don't have any data on the gut biome of a healthy turkey versus a sick turkey, but my gut tells me that the increased capsaicin in the turkey's system creates a spicy environment where this worm's like, this is not where I want to be. And it just unlatches and gets passed out. But that's complete speculation. The important thing is cayenne pepper's dirt cheap. If I can dump it on turkey food and the turkey doesn't die, I'm going to do it.
Especially it's since so it doesn't cheap, you would never grow food. Your own. Like, a person has to be dialed in on growing that. That's a New Mexico product, not a Pennsylvania. Yeah,
you can get
product.
A 5-pound bag, and it probably costs more to ship the 5-pound bag than would make sense for me to grow a single cayenne pepper.
It's like a fast food place. They have more money in the cup than the soda inside it, right? Like,
right.
Yeah.
It's cheap.
It would be interesting, though, if pure capsaicin, if that's cheap, because I don't know if it is, but if it is, then just
maybe
like
you'd use less.
Well, I'm just thinking, just like you're going to do with the oil of oregano oil, right? You could then, that could be infused in water.
It's I don't know.
The guardian dog that decides to lap some of the turkey water.
You hear yelping.
They'll do it once. They'll do
so
it
I use time. I use elevated waters that down to bell waters.
Yeah.
I'm done with – I will never use water that sits on the ground again. It makes no sense. Everything needs to be hanging.
All right, so Richard says, where does one apply for a farmer study grant? Well, we kind of did that already.
You have to go to the SARE website for their region.
And if you just go, it is SARE, SARE.org, especially for you guys who are listening, not watching. For those of you folks that are watching, you can see on the screen right there, that's the main website. And, you know, when he says your region, they're actually right here. Like, there's a map and you can select your, I don't remember. Oh, grants.
Well, I think it's across the top there. See it across the top?
North. Oh, yeah, right here. Yeah, north, central, northeast, southern, and western, right? So you can get, you know, apply by region is the way this is designed. And this is one source of grants, too. I would just encourage people, like, there's a lot of different sources of grants. This is one place to look and for a specific type of like research grant, but there's infrastructure grants like from NRCS. You know, I am not real friendly with the general bureaucrats in government, but guys, I mean, NRCS, SARE, things like this, these are like the most benign things our government does. And they actually have a really useful good output. And I know people are going to make the free market argument of, but there's better ways to do it. Yeah, but you're not doing that, right? It's not what we have. And that's why I call some of them special libertarians, because you're not in touch with the reality and there's no pragmatism.
Well, and you make a good argument, right? Like, you pay your taxes.
Yeah.
And the government's going to tax every dollar you earn.
Yes.
So
for the rest of my
life.
If
this is an opportunity to get some money back, a portion of it's yours, a portion of it is Richard's here, right? So,
yeah,
you know, if he's not going to go after his dollar, I will.
I'll take your money, man. I don't think he's saying that either.
No. I'm sure he's not. Yeah. He's just on the screen.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, there we go. I had a gremlin hit me again. Let's see. This one is from Goshawk. That's interesting, considering earlier discussion. Yeah. And he didn't get back to me. I put some text in because I was not really sure. Oh, wait. He did, and this is his restatement, I think. Yeah. We are trying 6 pullets this year. We are planning on moving them through the woods using poultry nets. Does trimming the flight feathers impact their ability to roost? Okay, that's what he was asking in the first question.
I've never done that. And mine do roost. When I had them in that Siskovich style chicken tractor with the poultry net around it, I would come out and they would always be on top of the chicken tractor. That's where they would sleep unless I forced them to go inside, which resulted in the tarp being completely shredded very quickly. But I didn't cut their feathers. I just got into the habit of forcing them to go to bed inside, and I would lock them in for the night.
Yeah, and you may want to consider it, the person that's asking the question, for like maybe even totally different reasons, depending on exactly how you're going to manage this. So I only ever lost a significant number of turkeys 1 year, and I ended up fixing that problem by clipping wings. And I have about a 4-foot chain link that goes all the way around my property. And about 4 of them decided they wanted to know what was on the other side of the fence. And so they went over the fence. And then they never came back. And there's a problem that turkeys seem to have. And part of their reputation for being stupid, I think, is that like, oh, I want to go there. And they see a fence. So then they go over the fence. But then the turkey brain cannot comprehend go back over the fence to get home. Like, because we've had chickens do it, and like, if they don't get eaten by something back there at night, they just come right back. And of the 4 that went over, I was able to get 1 back, and I had to go to my neighbor's. I ain't climbing that thing with the barbed wire on it and all, and go around, because he was doing this like a dog trying to find a way into a door,
on a hole or something,
back and forth and back and forth. He wouldn't, even though they flew over it to get out, they couldn't, you know, work out to fly over to get back. And I went through my neighbor's woods and couldn't find the other 3. And I'm like, okay, the hell with that.
Yeah, they're not.
And then eventually they get big enough. They're not they're not wild turkeys. Once they get to a certain weight, that ass ain't getting up in the air anyway.
No, it might get up a foot, but not into a tree.
I did have 6 or 7 poults one time. They're like half grown on my grill, roosting on the grill. And I'm like, I posted a picture. I said they were self-grilling turkeys. They're jumping ahead in the game, you know.
Yeah, when they're babies like that, when they're like 2 months old, 2.5 months old, they can fly a good 8-9 feet in the air. But you're right. Yeah. Once they get big, they're not interested in getting up. They'll hop like a foot off the ground, but really they're content to stay on the ground.
Yeah. I had some Egyptian family chickens one time, and they're really light-bodied. And because they kept getting into places they weren't supposed to, I clipped their wings. And I would watch them. They would get belly up to the fence, jump as high as they can, and flap what they could, and like they start going sideways. But they'd get that beak, and they'd hook the top of that fence, and they just pull their little ass up over the fence, man. It's like animals are creative, I guess, even when they're dumb. I can't believe any of them are that smart, given, you know, you literally are talking pea brain. But but anyway, CJ, man, thanks for being with us today. I really appreciated it. A lot of great information. I definitely encourage people who have agricultural land, who want to get into the business of farming, you know, like, you file that Schedule F, right? You're not going to make enough money to hurt yourself doing it anyway.
I mean, if it's your first year, you're probably not making money in the first place, not on paper.
When we were full commercial with the ducks, I think our best year was like $28,000, but we wrote off like $24,000.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But when you're applying for shit, what they're really looking at is revenue. right? Mm-hmm. They're not looking at, because
they don't care about profit.
Understands the game, right? Everyone understands things like phantom expenses and things like that.
Certainly. And yeah, and so if anybody has any questions about Sarah, you can reach out to Sarah directly. And if you have any questions that I can help with, I'm not opposed to people shooting me an email, and I'll help them out where I can.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Anyway, man, thanks for being with us today.
Yep. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
And folks, if you want to check out CJ's website, it is skylinepastures.com. And I will have links to that, plus his social media and things like that, in the show notes today. So again, thanks, CJ.
Thank you again.
All right, folks, real quick, I just want to remind you guys you can help support the show by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. And one of the things you can buy there right now is get a copy of my book, Laws of Life, Book 2, Now Design the System for Your Life. We continue to do really well on Amazon with the book. A month into it now since it dropped. I appreciate all of you have picked up a copy of it. If you haven't picked up a copy yet, please consider doing so. And if you have, especially some younger folks in your life, say 15 to 35, this might be the kick in the pants that they need. And they might take the kick in the pants a little bit more proactively from a book than you trying to tell them about something yet again, because a prophet has no honor in his own country. And if that, of course, means you don't know anything, and don't think that's limited to just you. I don't know anything in my home either, I promise you. Next up today, though, the item of the day from T-Spaz is the Anker Soundcore V20i open-ear headphones. These things are great. I've been using them for a very long time. I talked about it yesterday, so I won't overdo it today. But, I mean, this is my third set of them, and they've never broken. I've just, you know, put them somewhere or lost the case or whatever, but they're great. And I love these things because they don't fall out of your ear into a stock tank and then you never find them, or into the tall grass and you run them over with a lawnmower, or you don't, you know, what have you. So you keep them. And then if you do lose them right now, when they're on sale at 40% off, you're at $29. And that's like, if people have asked me, like, why don't you buy a higher end set of headphones? Like, you like audio and all. And it's, first of all, I don't hear that good anyway. But these are great sounding, but I just can't afford to trust myself with $200 Beats or something like that. And if you feel the same way, pick these up. Again, super long battery life, great sound. And Anker even has a app that will work with your Android phone or your Apple phone or what have you, where you can actually set up individual profiles for your different devices, including the speakers, your own EQ settings and things like that. And you can even name the individual devices, so it doesn't just say Anker, 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 Anker on your phone. You can't remember which one is which. So you can do that as well. Anyway, guys, I really appreciate you guys being with us today. Thanks for tuning in. And I will catch you tomorrow with an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. I was a little thin on content, so I sent out a Piker tree shaking email to the council, and several segments came in just while we were on the horn here with CJ. So we will definitely have good material for you tomorrow. Probably a little bit of a surplus. It's always nice. And with that, we'll get that out to you tomorrow, and then we'll do it all again next week.
Said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.